Good evening, everyone. This is Chrissy Houlihan, and welcome to this Our Town Hall. I'm very, very happy to be joined by my co-hosts tonight, Representatives Madeline Dean and Mary Gay Scanlon. For those of you guys who have joined Our Town Halls before, welcome back. And if this is your first time, we're really happy to have you here with us this evening. We have hundreds and hundreds of people on the line, and shortly will be thousands, I think. But before we get to our discussion, let me point out that we are permitted by law only to discuss official activities during this discussion. What that means is during this call, we cannot discuss political campaigns or political candidates. Or you can think of it this way. We can discuss policies, but not politics. Now, let me tell you how tonight's meeting is going to run, because it's quite large. We have a constitutional law scholar here and Georgetown professor David Vladek here with us tonight, and he's done a couple of these town halls across the country with great success, and we are privileged to have him. We've asked him to help us understand the legal landscape and litigation activity that is ongoing against the Trump administration and its actions. But before we turn to the professor, please allow me to introduce my colleagues. First, I'll start with Representative Madeline Dean to say hello.
Well, thank you, Representative Houlihan. Thank you, Chrissy, for bringing us all together. I'm really happy to have this chance for this joint town hall to talk with some of your constituents, and I'm sure there's going to be some overlap. Hi, everybody. I'm Madeline Dean. I'm Congresswoman for Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District, which is most of Montgomery County and a large swath of Berks County. And a sincere thank you to you, Chrissy, for hosting us this evening. You've assembled quite the group who can speak to these turbulent times, can speak to the legislative and judicial responses to the Trump administration. This is not normal, what we are going through. This is turbulence. I know many offices have been hosting events like this, mine included, and what my team and I have heard literally from hundreds and hundreds of Pennsylvanians is fear and anxiety. We're hearing concerns about Trump's slew of overreaching, sometimes blatantly illegal executive orders, empowering of Elon Musk, gutting federal agencies, levying huge tariffs on our allies, cutting off aid to Ukraine, the list goes on. In addition to concerns, we've heard questions, mainly what are Democrats doing? Right now, we're working on, I call it three pillars or three pathways to tackling these challenging times, litigation, legislation, and mobilization. Litigation, and you're going to hear quite a bit about that tonight. The power of the courts to make sure that the rule of law, the separation of powers, is upheld. Legislation, that's us, the power of Congress. Importantly, in this setting, the power of Congress to use oversight to dig into what is going on, what is right, what is wrong, what is an overreach. And finally, all of us, you on the line, mobilization. That's where people come in, engaged civic response, good questions, which I know we will get plenty of, but an engaged citizenry is actually what is going to help us through this challenging time. So tonight, we'll share updates about our work in these areas, but most especially, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on what lies ahead, what these things mean to you and your family, and what lies ahead. So Chrissy, I will toss it back to you with my thanks.
Thank you very much, Representative Dean. And without further ado, I'll also introduce my third colleague in southeastern Pennsylvania, Representative Mary Gay Scanlon. Mary Gay, could you go ahead and introduce yourself and your community?
Sure. Thanks, Chrissy. It's great to be here with you all today for this really important conversation. So I'm Mary Gay Scanlon. I'm the Congresswoman for Pennsylvania's 5th District, which is Delaware County as well as parts of Montgomery County and Philadelphia. So with my colleagues here on the line, we cover a big chunk of Philly and its suburban counties. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening, particularly our guest, Professor Vladek, for joining us to help everyone understand all the litigation that's been filed in the past few weeks to challenge these sweeping and really unprecedented executive actions that the Trump administration has taken. I know my office and my colleagues' offices have received thousands of calls and messages and emails since day one of this presidency, as people have really serious concerns about the actions taken by the Trump administration, the billionaire buddy Elon Musk, and some of the architects of Project 2025 who are now embedded in this administration, and how their actions can affect Americans' personal privacy, their financial security, and the critical government services or benefits they rely upon. You know, we're only a little over a month into Trump's term, and the Justice Department is already defending dozens of lawsuits challenging the administration's actions. Judges have temporarily stopped several of these top priorities from taking effect, and we'll get some update about that. But it's really clear the White House is pushing the legal limits, inviting this wave of legal challenges and really testing our constitutional system, particularly the separation of powers. So, you know, we are using all of the tools at our disposal to keep you informed, to disrupt and ultimately stop these attacks on our Constitution, and to protect everyone's rights and privacy. So, looking forward to the conversation, and Chrissy, I'll pass it back to you.
Thank you, Mary Gay, and I am embarrassed to say that I am the only person on the line here speaking tonight that is not a lawyer. Speaking of lawyers, please allow me to introduce a final special guest before we turn to Professor Vladeck. We are joined for just a couple of minutes by House Assistant Minority Leader Joe Neguse. Joe represents Colorado's 2nd Congressional District, and Representative Neguse also chairs the Litigation and Rapid Response Task Force. And that's a task force here in Congress in Washington where we all are speaking to you from, which is a clearinghouse for the House Democrats' strategy in responding to the unlawful and unconstitutional actions that are ongoing by the Trump White House. So we asked Joe to drop by tonight to give you a very quick peek into the work of the task force, and I will turn it over to Joe. Joe, over to you.
Well, thank you, first and foremost, Representative Houlihan, for convening tonight's important Teletown Hall, and what a privilege it is to be able to join you and Representative Scanlon and Representative Dean, of course, the four of us having all come into the United States Congress at the same time back in 2018. As Representative Houlihan mentioned, I have the privilege of serving as the Assistant Minority Leader, which means I get the opportunity to work with incredible and talented and thoughtful public servants like Representative Houlihan, who really has been the tip of the spear with respect to helping us develop strategies to respond to the Trump administration's actions that are impacting our national security, which I'll talk a bit about. By way of background, as Representative Houlihan articulated, Leader Jeffries, just a few short weeks ago, impaneled and convened a Rapid Response Task Force and Litigation Working Group. And the core purpose behind this entity is to ultimately serve as a hub, a clearinghouse of leveraging the talents and the expertise in the House Democratic Caucus to respond to the unlawful and unconstitutional actions that the Trump administration has taken, both with respect to agency actions as well as executive orders. As, of course, you'll hear from our distinguished professor that's joining tonight's Teletown Hall, there are over 100 cases now pending with respect to executive orders and agency actions. And in the vast majority of these cases, the Trump administration has failed in its effort to defend the propriety of its actions. House Democrats are working via this task force and its members to do everything we can to respond legislatively and in the courts by virtue of speaking with a singular voice in the appropriate court cases as they proceed through the federal courts, which we did just last week by ultimately submitting an amicus brief at the trial court level in a particular case concerning the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, an important matter that I'm sure the professor will touch on. One of the strategies that we are deploying to respond to the Trump administration is, as I mentioned, leveraging the expertise of our members. And we are so grateful that Representative Houlihan has agreed to be the lead on national security matters within the task force, helping the caucus understand the consequences and implications for our national security by virtue of the Trump administration's actions, and informing the legislative and oversight tools that we're pursuing as a practical matter to respond. We are grateful to her in particular for leading an effort on the floor just last week of the United States House of Representatives to issue a clarion call to the country about the national security implications of, in particular, some of the Trump administration's recent actions, and ultimately organizing a group of members, national security experts like herself, who have served our country so bravely, to ultimately make that case directly to the American people using the bully pulpit that all of you have bestowed upon us in service to our country. So I will stop it there because I know you're going to be hearing from, as I mentioned, the professor, and of course I suspect many of you have questions. I would simply encourage you to reach out to the task force. We require your suggestions, your ideas, your proposals. This is an all-hands-on-deck moment for our republic, and it's going to require the engagement of each and every person in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, whom are so ably represented by Representative Houlihan and, of course, my colleagues, Representative Scanlon and Representative Dean. So with that, I will turn it back to you, Representative Houlihan, and again, I thank you for your efforts.
Thank you very much, and I'm going to turn it back over to Representative Scanlon, who has the privilege of introducing our special guest star. Over to you, Mary Gay.
Okay, thank you, and we want to get right to everyone's questions, so allow me to introduce David Bladek, the A.B. Chettle Chair in Civil Procedure at Georgetown Law School. Professor Bladek teaches civil procedure, federal courts, a practicum on privacy and technology, which he teaches jointly with MIT, and he directs the Civil Litigation Clinic, a student clinic that handles trial court litigation focused on public interest cases. He's also the faculty director of the Center on Privacy and Technology. He took a leave from Georgetown to serve as the director of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection from 2009 to 2012. And prior to joining Georgetown's faculty full-time, he spent more than 25 years with Public Citizen Litigation Group, which is, in fact, the organization responsible for bringing many of the legal actions against the Trump administration that are currently in play. So in other words, Professor Bladek is exactly the person we need to hear from tonight to give us insight and help everyone understand what's happening on the litigation front. Knowing we'd have a really big audience tonight, our three offices asked for questions in advance, and we received hundreds of suggested questions. So to preserve as much time for Professor Bladek as possible, we've organized those questions into major themes, and we'll focus our remaining time on them. So let's get to it. Professor Bladek, thank you for joining us. Can you open by talking a little bit about who is filing these lawsuits against the administration and on whose behalf? Many constituents have been surprised to learn that members of Congress usually aren't able to file lawsuits themselves challenging administration action. So who is filing it on whose behalf?
Well, that's a great question. So far, there are more than 100 lawsuits pending against the administration. Many have been filed by state attorneys generals. Many have been filed by unions representing federal workers who have been discharged unlawfully. In many cases, by public interest groups like my former colleagues at Public Citizen Litigation Group, representing companies and, you know, and others, for example, who were helping AID carry out its functions. There are also lots of cases involving the effort by Doge and Musk to hollow out agencies like the Consumer Financial Protection Board, AID, the Department of Education, the FDA, the NIH, and there are more and more. And so, yeah, there's an army of lawyers doing these cases, and by and large, they're winning. And, you know, one way to do this is to start out with this morning, when the Supreme Court ruled that the administration must pay debts to companies, organizations, and others that have supplied material to AID. Now, understand this. The issue is whether the federal government should pay debts that it was owed. And the court, 5-4, said yes. The key constitutional issue, though, is much broader. Congress passes spending laws, and once the president signed them, they are laws. And the only role of the executive branch is to carry out Congress's decisions. And so we've seen the safety valve of appropriations, you know, is being blocked by the administration. There's no good reason for it. You know, if the president thinks that the money should not be spent, there's a statute, it's called the Impoundment Control Act, that allows the president to ask Congress to reconsider spending. But it's up to Congress not to make that, it's up to Congress to make that decision. So I'm happy to talk about almost any of the wide variety of cases that are pending. There are cases about Doge and Elon Musk and what is the heck he's doing here. There's actually something funny. Last night, during the president's message, he said, and now I'm going to quote, he says that Elon Musk is the head of Doge. Well, in all of the cases that are pending so far, the government has sworn declarations that Musk is not a government official. But the president said, you know, that Doge is headed by Elon Musk. So starting today, there are going to be a lot of government lawyers who are going to have to go to courts and say, you know, we were wrong. We said that Doge was not headed by Elon Musk and that Elon Musk was not, you know, is not a government employee. They're going to have to go back and eat crow because the president said otherwise. So there are lots of cases about Doge. There are lots of cases about mass firing of federal workers who have civil service protection. There are attacks on agencies like AID, the CFPB, the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration, the Education Department, and there are a bunch of cases involving the firing of commissioners or other top officials, you know, the Office of Special Counsel, a commissioner of the EEOC, a commissioner of the National Labor Relations Board, and others, high-level personnel who had tenure. That is, they could only be fired if they did something wrong. But the day that President Trump was confirmed, he fired all of these people. And those cases are in the courts as well. So it's hard to imagine any case involving the federal government that isn't in litigation. And I'm happy to answer more discreet questions about any of these kinds of cases, but the district courts are doing a great job in adjudicating these cases. The courts of appeals have many of these cases now, and the Supreme Court this morning basically told Donald Trump, you got to obey the law. Even if you're president, you got to obey the law. So, fire away with questions.
Okay, that's certainly gives us a big overview. And for folks who are interested, there's a couple different websites where you can look up the various cases that are under litigation. There's one that's called Fix the Court. There's another that's the Civil Rights Litigation Clearinghouse. And then there's the Just Security Litigation Tracker. And so they track these dozens and dozens now, I guess, over 100 cases. But I think, Representative Dean, you have the next question.
Thank you very much. And Professor, it's a pleasure to be with you on this telephone town hall. You can imagine we've had a tremendous number of questions about Elon Musk. You just somewhat connected to this first question that Deborah from Pottstown and Paul from Spring City, but as I said, dozens and dozens of others have asked us. They ask, does Musk's access to our personal information, is that legal, and by what means is it legal? If it's not legal, what are the cases challenging Musk? What protections do we have to our personal information?
That's a great question. There is a statute called the Privacy Act that by and large protects information held by the government that may be, you know, important, like Social Security information or tax information. For people who've worked in the government, the Office of Personnel Management has a huge amount of personal information. And what is troubling is Doge and Musk have had broad access to all of these databases, which contain all sorts of very, you know, all sorts of information. So, you know, do you pay your taxes on time? Do you take deductions? If you're working for, you know, almost any government agency has databases on individuals. And the Privacy Act was designed to force agencies to essentially, to first of all, to protect the data, but also not to share it. And what's happening here is, and we don't know exactly what's going on with DOGE. DOGE is going agency by agency, and we believe just vacuuming up tons and tons of data that can be used for all sorts of nefarious purposes. And I share your constituents' concern about the ability of DOGE to basically have free access to all of the most, you know, important databases there is. And there's litigation fighting against that kind of access. There are plenty of cases in court where the key argument is that DOGE and Musk should not have access to this. By and large, the courts are pushing back on the government, on DOGE. Of course, DOGE doesn't exist as an agency, though some judges have said that they are. But that's something that I think everyone who's been involved in this litigation is really worried about. You know, who does Musk report to? Who is he obligated to? And you know, the government has always said he's not a government employee, but the president says he runs DOGE. And we haven't gotten to the bottom of it because the government has said repeatedly that he's not a government officer and therefore is not subject to government control.
Thank you for that.
Yeah,
so
Professor, so much so.
Yes. Yeah.
Professor,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Anand. This is Representative Houlihan, and for those who are maybe joining late, what we're trying to do is we had hundreds of questions. We've tried to consolidate as many as we can, and I see other questions are coming in, and I hope that we're addressing them to the degree that we are able with these questions that many people have asked. We have had a lot of questions about USAID, including some from my district. Katie in Coatesville and Robert in Westchester had very similar questions. They're asking about the firing of staff and the freezing of funds for USAID and other things. Can you tell us what have the courts said about this so far? Where are we headed? And if it's okay, I'm going to throw in a bonus question for you because some people have asked online, who's paying for all these court cases?
Well, for many of these cases, nobody's paying for them. I mean, for example, Public Citizen and Democracy Forward are doing much of this work. And they're nonprofit public interest organizations that would love donations, but they're doing it because this is what they were born to do. Now, let's get back to your question about the mass firings. There are two responses to what's going on at AID. One is, how do we get the money to the people who need to provide the food, the medicines, the technical work that people who, you know, AID was formed for a good reason, to help people in other countries, you know, have a better life. And so there are two aspects to this. One is there's a lot of money that had been appropriated by Congress. Congress has not withdrawn that appropriation. So the next step will not just simply be to pay the people who've already, you know, done their work, but to pay the people who work for aid and to get the money that Congress appropriated for foreign aid, get them to where they need it, like the Sahara, like Africa. And so those cases are still pending. The first step was to get people who, you know, had done the work to get paid. But the second step is to use the appropriation the way Congress defined it, which is to help poor people in, you know, in terrible shape. And the government, you know, this administration needs to either tell Congress that there should be a rescission, that is, Congress should decide to take back the money. But if Congress doesn't do that, and I can't imagine Congress would, then there is no option for the executive branch other than to follow the appropriation and send all of this aid to where it should be now, not 6 months from now, to help people who are starving and need medical help and so forth. This is a tragedy of the administration's making. The courts are doing what they can to move the money out, but, you know, it takes courts a while to get final judgments, and the government here is fighting tooth and nail to block this kind of aid. It's heartbreaking. But the courts will ultimately prevail in AIDS, you know, in AIDS position. I can't imagine Congress doing otherwise. But you know, it's going to take time, and in the meantime, lots of people are going to die, and for no good reason. Sorry to be so somber about it. That's the reality.
We had the director of USAID in front in a small roundtable today, Professor, a closed-door, no-press roundtable, and it was very, very troubling, the lack of answers.
Heartbreaking.
You know, we're talking about all these court decisions, and as you say, more than 100 are litigation pieces are filed, some in lower courts, and today the opinion by the Supreme Court. I know my colleagues and I have had so many questions about enforcing court decisions, the worry that how do we make sure the rule of law prevails and that the decisions will be upheld and enforceable. David from Westchester, Glenn from Morgantown, they ask, how will the courts make sure the administration is abiding by their decisions? Will they issue contempt orders? What can Congress do if the executive branch refuses to comply?
Well, that will be a constitutional, terrible. That's the scenario that everyone thinks won't happen. And take a look at today's Supreme Court case. You had three. Three Democrats and two Republicans siding with the Constitution and requiring AID to send out, you know, nearly $2 billion of money. The courts actually have a lot of authority to put people in jail if they fail to comply with court orders. Generally, if someone is held in contempt, they will try to avoid going to jail by simply carrying out whatever the court has ordered. And so far, there has not been any pushback by the administration so far, this administration has not gone into contempt or done something to draw contempt. What happened with respect to the AID money was simply an appeal to the Court of Appeals and ultimately to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said to the administration, you've got to send out that money, and they will. But if it comes to a time where the courts issue a ruling and the government says, we're not going to obey it, well, then the courts have plenty of authority. There are jails in the basement of every courthouse in the United States, federal courthouse. You know, the judges can simply say bailiff seize that officer and put him into jail until he's no longer in contempt. I hate to see that happen. There have been times in my litigation practice where the government was not complying with a court order, and the judge basically said, look, you have two choices. Bring a toothbrush, because you're going to be here for a while, or do what I told you to do. And ultimately, the government employee did what the judge ordered. So we're a long way before any collision about contempt. But it is an incredibly powerful judicial power, and the courts do have, you know, jails, and they put people in them. And so I just hope it doesn't come to that. Look, what Trump is doing, he's trying to, you know, basically, you know, flood the zone. And he's trying to get as much as he wants to get really quickly, but not necessarily thoughtfully. And most of these cases, the government is going to lose. The government is already starting to lose a lot in these cases. And, you know, for example, the cases involving civil servants. Well, you can't file a civil servant who's been on the job for a while. Why? Because the civil servants have access to the Merit Protection Review Board, which is a, you know, just not an agency, but it's not a court or an agency. But it is a federal, it's a federal tribunal that goes through claims by people who have been fired, you know, to ensure that they were fired for good reason. Here, these people are discharged simply because they're in the way. And ultimately, most of these people will either get their job back or will get some sort of financial money for the wrongful discharge. And so there are going to be lots of these cases. The federal government is going to end up paying a lot of money for people who didn't work because the president wanted them fired for whatever reason they want, other than to look like they were streamlining the government. But ultimately, all these people who were wrongfully discharged, you know, will either get severance or they'll go back to work. So that's where we are with, for example, these mass firings. It's a gesture by Trump, but it's not a gesture that's going to ultimately persuade judges or, for example, the Merit Protection Review Board.
Yeah, and I wanted to circle back around on that because you were asked a bonus question about who's paying for these lawsuits, and you mentioned that we do have some really wonderful public interest law firms that bring the lawsuits free of charge, but we also need to consider with all these suits on behalf of fired workers that their union dues is paying for the suits on behalf of them. And of course, there's a cost to the taxpayers whenever the Department of Justice has to defend the government for these wrongful discharges. But I wanted to move on to a question. We got a question from Kenneth in Kennett Square and Roseanne in Malvern, and they asked, once Congress has passed laws deciding which programs get funded and how much, isn't the administration responsible for following through and spending those funds as intended? People have had a lot of questions about the power of the purse and what happens when a president doesn't spend money that Congress has allocated. You mentioned the concept known as impoundment. So, Professor Vladeck, is it legal for the president to decide all on his own not to spend money that Congress has directed?
No, the president does not have that power. So let me just do a quick history of this. Back in the Nixon era, he did not want to spend a lot of money that Congress had appropriated for clean water. And there were two cases before the Supreme Court about whether the president had the power to say, to Congress, I'm not going to spend money that you appropriate. And in two cases, two Supreme Court cases, the Supreme Court said no, right? The Constitution gives Congress, not the President, the right to appropriate money. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the President has the power of stopping to appropriate money. And so after the Nixon case, Congress enacted something called the Impoundment Control Act, which gave them essentially real authority to force a president to spend money that he or she doesn't want to spend, but Congress did. And, you know, the power under the Impoundment Control Act, when it was originally passed, was based on House, either a one House or two House veto. And in the Chadha case, the Supreme Court said legislative veto is not constitutional. But then Congress redrafted the Impoundment Control Act to give the president two options. One is they could ask Congress to repeal all of the appropriation. That's called the rescission. Congress has to do that. Both houses of Congress have to agree. That's not happening here. Then there's another theory that the Impoundment Control Act, which allows a president to defer spending, but he's got to spend. He can have a few months if he goes to Congress and says, look, I want to slow down spending on this package or something like that. He has the authority to go ask Congress. He doesn't have the authority to do this on his own. Congress is the one that does all of the work on appropriations. And so, you know, your constituents are exactly right. Congress is the one that has the power of the purse, not the president. And there is, I think that many of these cases will be lost to the administration because they're trying to accrete power to them that, you know, plainly lies within Congress. So, yes, you know, Trump wants to avoid spending all sorts of money that Congress has appropriated, but he doesn't have the power to do what he's trying to do.
Well, I think I'm up. Is that okay, Chrissy?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's your turn.
Professor, this is so interesting. We're going to have to do this again in a couple of weeks, if you don't mind. Maureen from Nottingham and Catherine from Downingtown asked a question that is related to some of the answers you just gave, which is Doge legal? And does that matter if Doge is actually legally established? Layered into that is what you just indicated in terms of the administration folks saying Elon Musk is a government employee, he's not a government employee, and then last night at the joint address, the president saying he is. My question is, are these important questions to find out whether or not Doge is legal and who is in charge there? Does that have bearing on the outcome of this litigation? And I guess a broader question I have, Professor, is have you ever seen precedent for this level of litigation against a new administration?
Well, let me answer the first question. The second question, which is no, there's nothing been quite like this before. When President Reagan took office, there was a lot of back and forth between him and Congress, but nothing of this magnitude. So is Doge okay? Well, it depends on whether the president is right or not. So if Doge is a governmental entity, it has to be something that fits within the Administrative Procedure Act. And it could be an agency. It could be an advisory committee, which is what I thought it would be. But it's very hard to pin down what its what its constitution is, because the government has by and large said he's not a government employee, but he is somehow affiliated with Doge. And he can't do both. If you're not a government official, then you don't have any right to do almost anything. But even if you are a good friend of the president, but if Doge is an agency or some other construct, then it has a right to do some things that agencies have the right to do. So there's been one decision by Judge John Bates saying that, by and large, Doge is an agency. And if it's an agency, he's subject to all sorts of things like the Freedom of Information Act, the Privacy Act, a whole host of statutes that apply to agencies. Now, there really is no other aspect other than non-governmental actors who advise government. So we do have, we do have statutes that set up, advisory boards. And one judge thought, well, this is an advisory board, but if it's an advisory board, who's it advising, and what are they doing? So the government, until last night, took the position that that Doge was an aspect of the office of the president, and therefore had power to essentially work with agencies to make them more efficient and to root out fraud and abuse. But what turned out is, they've been to 12, 15 agencies, and as far as we know, what Doge has been doing is looking at most of the databases that the government has acquired, including the IRS and the Department of Labor, the Department of Education, AID, and by and large has just been vacuuming up whatever data they want. And so that's why there's so much litigation against Musk and Doge, because the government has played, games about whether it's an agency or not. And, as I said before, at sometime tomorrow morning, there are going to be a bunch of government employee lawyers who are going to have to eat crow and basically say to judges, I was wrong. He is the head of Doge, and therefore he has to be a government employee. So that's where we are on that. And remember, Elon Musk gets at least $38 billion a year from the federal government. Just think about that. And he wants more. And so there's just a whole escalade of conflicts of interest here. He has not signed, if he's a government employee, when I went to work at the Federal Trade Commission, I had to give the government everything that's important about my salary, how much money I have, what investments I have, and I worked for Ralph Nader. I didn't have very much to say about it. But why is not Elon Musk filling out one of those forms? If he's working for the government, anyone has to do that. He hasn't done it. And that's been raised in a lot of these cases. So,
right.
So that's a long-winded answer to say that, Musk is a real problem, and many of the judges are still scratching their head because the government has not come clean about who he is and what he's doing here. And increasingly, the judges are getting very concerned about Musk's role, particularly since, he wants to tear down all of the agencies that he's had quarrels with.
Right, and that seems to be, I mean, it kind of goes to the fundamental separation of power and how you have oversight and how you get transparency into what's going on with Doge and Musk and everything.
That's the reason why why the Freedom of Information Act is so important. There have been lots of Freedom of Information Act requests sent to Doge, and all of them have just, they're in a pile somewhere.
Right. Right. Ordinarily, they would have to be answered by someone within certain time frames.
Yes.
Well, similarly, about checks and balances and such, you mentioned earlier that Trump had issued orders basically taking over some of these independent agencies and firing the inspectors general and these watchdogs. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what this is. The night he was confirmed, he spent a lot of time firing people. He fired one of the EEOC commissioners, NLRB commissioner, so much so that the NLRB can't work because there's no quorum. So he has fired a lot of high-level people who, under statute, have tenure and can only be discharged for doing something bad. The statutes are different in their formulation, but by and large, these are people with 10 years of tenure and can only be fired if they have done something really bad. And so there are a bunch of these cases now pending. One is with the Office of Special Counsel. The case had been filed in district court in D.C. because the special counsel had been fired. But the lower court required him to be put back in office. And the Supreme Court upheld, this is a stay, there's still litigation. But the Supreme Court basically said, no, this guy can stay where he is until we get to adjudicate whether the firing was all right. And so there are a bunch of these cases. There'll be more about kneecapping agencies by taking away commissioners. But at some point, these cases are going to get to the Supreme Court. The ones about the EEOC and the NLRB are still in the district courts. They'll go up quickly to the courts of appeals. But these are really important cases because, by and large, there are a number of independent agencies that are not really under the umbrella of the executive branch. And Congress devised systems to keep them sort of, at some length between the president. For example, the Federal Trade Commission has always had partisan commissioners, right? They're three from one party, two from the other. And Congress, by and large, has appreciated the fact that they are not beholden to the president or to OMB. But Trump has put out an executive order basically saying, those protections don't exist. And therefore, if Trump gets up in the morning and decides, Alvaro Bedoya, who's a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission, he's a Democrat, let's just get rid of him. Those are cases that are already being litigated in a host of agencies. And at some point, sooner rather than later, you're going to make it to the Supreme Court, and we'll see. But in the meantime, there is no legal authority for these firings. Trump just said, you're fired. I guess he thinks he's still on TV. I don't know. But that's what happened. And those cases are pending. They're moving through the courts. By and large, the plaintiffs are winning in the lower courts. I suspect they'll win in the Supreme Court as well. But at least with the Office of Special Counsel, he's still in his job, and that's a good sign.
Well, we, Professor, so appreciate your expertise. This is Chrissy Houlihan again, and we have literally countless additional questions we could get to, and I agree with my colleagues that we definitely need to get the band back together again and have this conversation again. With what's left of our time, I would love to turn it over to Mary Gay, to Representative Scanlon, for a couple of minutes of closing remarks, and then over to Representative Dean as well. And Professor, thank you as well. Please hang on for a while because I have some closing remarks too, but we're really grateful to you, and I'll hand it over to Representative Scanlon.
Thank you, Chrissy. And I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening, and especially Dr. Vladeck for helping to explain some of this fast-moving political and legal landscape. You know, with Trump controlling the White House and both houses of Congress, the first line of resistance and defense is often going to be in the courts right now, and so there's a lot of activity there. We've been really excited to work with the Litigation and Rapid Response Task Force and coordinating with Representative Neguse and Representative Jamie Raskin and all the groups that are challenging the White House and DOJ actions in court. And we've been, as I think Representative Neguse mentioned, we've started filing amicus briefs where appropriate, including just a few days ago in the case seeking to block dismantling of the Consumer Finance Protection Board. And I think we're going to have another one coming up in the next day or two. So, It's important work. We really appreciate everyone for paying attention because we know this is overwhelming. That is the strategic purpose of this barrage coming out of the White House. But there are defenses, and we're going to work on them and try to get everything back on track here. Madeline, do you want to go ahead?
Thanks, Mary Gay, for tossing it to me. Chrissy, thank you for bringing us together. It was very good to be with Joe Neguse, one of our classmates from the class of 2018. Mary Gay, always great to be with you. And, Professor, I really mean it. We have to all talk again. We benefit from your teaching and your expertise as we try to navigate this incredibly challenging time. Chrissy, I know that there's quite a few people on here. Maybe you can give us an update on that when you close. I did a town hall 2 weeks into this administration, a telephone town hall. We were down here in session. We had 9,000 people on the call, people just concerned for the future of this country, for their family's future, for the jobs that some of their kids were in. So I'm going to do another town hall, sort of a hybrid town hall telephone with video, Facebook, tomorrow evening, and I hope some of the folks who are here tonight might join us. But we learn from you, our constituents. So thank you to all those who signed in, but also who offered these questions. I wish we could get to even more of them. What I have said to my constituents, again, this three-pronged approach, litigate, legislate, which really means oversight from the party in the minority, which is us, and mobilize, that we all have to be in this together. Sure, us as representatives, but I am certain it is every one of us that has to be in this together to be truth tellers, to fact check, to take a look at some of the very strange claims that were made last night that simply are not borne out by the facts. And most important that my team keeps saying is tell us your stories. We are literally connecting and collecting stories, whether you have family members who are impacted by firings, family members who are impacted by frozen resources, veterans who are impacted. Please share your stories. It is those stories that will inspire. It's not enough to just say, you know, 1,000 people got fired. That's just a number. We can't humanize that. But when you tell us your stories of the impact these things are having on you, if Medicaid is somehow dramatically cut, what impact that will have on you, tell us, share your stories so that we can learn from them and to argue to the best for the future of our country as we face these turbulent times. With that, I'm just super thankful to be with you all tonight, and I toss it back.
Thanks, Matt, and thank you to everybody who's joined us. I will conclude and close us out this evening to say I'm grateful for the conversation. Each of us here in Washington have heard a lot of anxiety, hundreds and thousands of calls over the last weeks, many of them asking a similar question, which kind of in summary says, what are you doing? What are the Democrats doing in particular? And I hope that today you've had an opportunity to hear from Representative Neguse and from the professor and from our rapid response efforts about the litigation actions and the strategy that is ongoing. And that sort of is my way of thinking about this is the three C's. I know Matt has her way of thinking about it. My C is for the courts. My C is for the Congress, legislation and oversight. My C is for the community. You all who have dialed in out there from our community, we work for you. We hear you. And I think at least from my community, which I know to be a very purple place, my community is a 6th congressional district, 40% R, 40% D, and 20% independent. My guess is there are many of us who are on this call tonight, and there are thousands of us on this call tonight who like what they see is happening. And I'm certain that there are many of us as well that don't like what they're seeing and are concerned about it. And so here's my parting advice for all of us who are here. Please communicate with those of us on the phone who are in government at all the different levels that you can, because your voice and your opinion and your story matters. Share your stories, as Madeline said. So what if anything has affected you and your life and your family from what is ongoing from this new administration? Let us know about it. Let's understand it. Support organizations, and you've heard a little bit of that today, who are actively working on causes or issues that matter to you. And again, this applies to anybody who's in support of what's happening and those who are not in support of what is happening. And then the last couple is please seek the truth. Seek the truth from places that you trust, from multiple sources as well. Misinformation is doing none of us any favors, and it is abundant, and it is coming from sources and places that want to do us harm. Follow our social medias of the three of us, please, and our newsletters as well. Reach out to us if we can help you each with any federal agency nexus. And finally, the last thing I will leave you with, and thank you again for coming, is please, 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 take care of yourselves. This is very stressful and difficult times for all of us. Take care of yourselves, your family, and one another. Thank you once again for coming. And with that, I bid you good night.